musical indicator or something to do with a pause as it's read, as it's said. But it does at least serve a purpose. It shows us some of the natural breaks in the text. And they provide me with a way of structuring the sermon, so that's how I've structured it. So it begins, verses 1 to 3, he recounts his anguish, his kfal, his elend. So let's get into the text and hear it in his own words. I cry aloud to God, and he will hear me. In the day of my trouble, I seek the Lord. In the night, my hand is stretched out without wearying. I think that means stretched out to God. My soul refuses to be comforted. When I remember God, I moan. When I meditate, my spirit faints. He is inconsolable, unvertröstlich. I think that's right, or untröstlich vielleicht. Even thinking about God doesn't seem to help. When I remember God, I moan. So he's in a pretty bad way. We don't know what's brought him to this point, what his particular afflictions are. As I say, maybe some defeat of the people of God, some destruction of the temple or something, some terrible spiritual weakness, some apostasy among the people perhaps. Or was it something to do with his own situation, some tragedy in his own life, in his family life, perhaps a broken heart? Or was it primarily something medical? I mean, it does read like a man suffering from depression. It could be simply he's suffering depression for chemical reasons more than anything else. But I'd suggest it's a good thing we don't know, because if we did, we would tend to read the psalm in the light of what we knew of his experience, so we would only see it as being relevant to someone who was in exactly the same position that he was in. But there are many situations which might give rise to this sort of anguish. Maybe we suffer some kind of loss or some disappointment. A dream is shattered. Something we longed hope for hasn't worked out. Maybe we're suffering because other people are making life difficult for us at work, in our studies, in our family situation. Maybe, as I said, we're simply clinically depressed, may have similar symptoms. Maybe we feel that our prayers are not being heard and that heaven is shut up against us. Maybe on a more corporate level, we're part of a church family which experiences some kind of a crisis or a setback or a struggle that is of such intensity that we begin to wonder if the Lord is still around. Just some of the possibilities. Almost certainly most of us can add to that list from our own experience. Times when we're in distress and we feel there's no sign of anything changing. So what does he do about it? Well, basically he uses the spiritual discipline of remembering, recalling, calling to mind what is not present. I.e., what is not present is a living experience of God answering his prayers. So he calls to mind what he knows of God answering prayers in the past, in his own experience or the experience of the people of God as a whole. Roughly speaking, I think we hear him doing that in three areas where he recalls. Maybe we could think of it as three levels in one of those computer games. As I understand it, don't play them myself. I'd be completely useless. But you can only proceed to the next level when you complete this level. And then you go to the higher level, and then to the higher level as your skill improves. Maybe something similar is happening here with his restoration to faith. As the faith recovers, so he's climbing from one level to the next. So level one in verses 4 to 9, he recalls God's unchanging character. He reassures himself by thinking through what he knows of God. And in a way, he's what we call in English devil's advocate. He sets out questions which sounds very impious, very fromm, but whose answer expects, which expect the answer, no way. So let me read from verse 4. You hold my eyelids open. Which, hard to know quite what's meant by that. Is it saying that God is causing him not to be able to sleep? We're not sure. Sleeplessness is often a feature of being in this sort of situation. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I consider the days of old, the years long ago. I said, let me remember my song in the night. Let me meditate in my heart. And so he does this. My spirit made a diligent search. And here come the questions, expecting the answer, no way. Will the Lord spurn, that is, reject forever and never again be favorable? Has his steadfast love forever ceased? No way. Are his promises at an end for all time? No way. Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his compassion? Surely, no way. And then he moves up to level 2. He recalls God's saving deeds. In verse 10, he pulls himself together even more. He resolves to think more positively, and to do that by focusing on the Lord, focusing on all the Lord has done in the past for his people. Then I said, I will appeal to this, to the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your might among the peoples. You with your arm redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph. You may recognize some of the events that he is probably referring to in the past. Similar, when we get to level 3, he recalls God's awesome presence. What is known as a theophany, where God appears on earth in some way. And probably in these next verses, if you listen carefully, he's thinking about the creation, where God appears and the waters are all churned up and so on. And the appearance on Mount Sinai to Moses, accompanied by all those earthquake, wind and fire and so on. And to the Exodus when he rescued his people from Egypt. Possibly also in the last verse to them crossing the Jordan into the promised land. Well, listen to it. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters. Yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Your footprints were unseen. Probably he's thinking along these lines. It's always been the case that you can't actually see God. You just know when he's around. There are signs of his presence, like these natural phenomena. But because his footsteps are unseen, he uses human agents, like in the last verse, Moses and Aaron. Human agents to do his work in the world, lead his people. So what has happened in the course of the psalm is not that God has changed, and not that his circumstances have changed, but that he has changed. Or we might say he has been changed by this spiritual discipline of recalling. So that by the end, his thinking is realigned around what he knows to be true of the God who has revealed himself in the past, in his deeds, in his appearances and so on. So he's back on an even keel. So the lesson for us is, of course, that when we're in that situation, when life is difficult, if you like, when the Lord's footsteps are unseen, then we need to go through that same process, recalling those things about God, his unchanging character, his saving deeds, his awesome presence. But there is one caveat, one point where diese Angaben sind ohne Gewähr. We're not actually told that he's back on an even keel. We don't know anything about his mood at the end of the psalm. In fact, it ends very abruptly. It sort of leaves us in midair, wondering if maybe he ran out of ink. Or in modern terms, maybe this was the point when his computer crashed and he didn't finish. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. It's a very unsatisfactory ending to this psalm. So we can't actually answer the most important question that it raises. Did it work, this spiritual discipline? We just assume that it did because we know, or we think that's how the Bible works. It tells us how to be godly. It tells us how to get sorted out. And if you do these things, there'll always be a happy ending. So we assume that it worked, but did it work? And the other way to read this psalm is to assume that it didn't, or at least that it hadn't worked by the time he came to the end of the psalm. And so this second sermon carries the title, not triumphant faith, but troubled faith. It starts in the same place. He recounts his own anguish. But maybe there are already hints in these first verses that things are not going to turn out as we might hope, as we might expect. Remember how thinking of God doesn't help. It makes things worse. When I remember God, I moan. When I meditate, my spirit faints. Why would that be? Well, it could be that it's because when he thinks about God, he realizes the size of the gap between what he believes about God and what he is actually experiencing of God and the present. A gap between belief and experience. All through the psalm, he declares what he believes, but often we have this feeling that there's a gap between that and what he's actually going through. He can't make the two come together. He recalls God's character. Remember those questions, assuming the answer, no way. Of course God wouldn't do that. But maybe that wasn't the conclusion he had in mind. Maybe that's just us assuming that he must be saying the right, faithful, godly, fromm thing. Maybe here too there's a gap that he can't paper over, so that these are real existential questions for him, questions to which he cannot give a clear answer. They're expressing the problem. He's heard that the answer is meant to be no way, but it feels to him that the answer is more like, I really can't be sure. And maybe it's in the tone of a cry of distress. Will the Lord spurn forever and never again be favorable? Ever again? Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Are his promises at an end for all time? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his compassion in heaven? See how the tone can be very different. Now, you may notice here,
there's a word missing from the subtitle. The word, he recalls God's unchanging character, we said first time round. And that brings us to the heart of the translation issue. And my justification for reading it this second way, which seems to be much less from, much less what we might expect from the scriptures. If you look carefully at verse 10, you'll find there's a footnote which gives a translation which is equally possible from the Hebrew. In case your eyesight isn't good enough, as mine is hardly, it's on the screen, I hope. This is my grief, that the right hand of the Most High has changed. Well, that's quite different, isn't it, from I will appeal to this, to the years of the right hand of the Most High. But it really is quite small differences in the Hebrew punctuation, puncta would make this possible. Interestingly, I notice that Luther goes for this second translation. Ich sprach, darunter leide ich, dass die rechte Hand des Höchsten sich so ändern kann. What could be worse than that? A God who keeps on changing. You can never be sure how he'll react. That's so often what pagan gods are like. Not the God of Israel, surely. We find it hard enough in human relationships to cope with human inconsistency. You can't build a strong friendship or a marriage if the other person is totally unpredictable. If there's no consistency from day to day on how they react and respond. Obviously, on one level, some variation and change is a good thing. There might be one day when they want some ice cream and another day when they want a coffee. But I'm meaning consistency on a deeper level than that, of commitments and values and priorities. It's impossible to build a friendship or a marriage if the other is constantly changing and unpredictable. You'd be constantly on tenterhooks, never able to relax and enjoy the relationship, never able to sit back and trust. Imagine God was constantly changing on that fundamental level. Well, I reckon that'd be cause enough for grief. This is my grief, that the right hand of the Most High has changed. However bravely he may tell himself that the everlasting God is unchanging, that's not how things seem to him. There's a gap, you see, between his belief and his experience. He can sing, as we did earlier, what is Yahweh, God unchanging. But his experience is, it doesn't feel that way. God doesn't seem to be keeping his promises. Some of you may know of that gap in your own experience, whatever the cause may be, from internal reasons, a depression or breakdown, external factors thrown upon us, the scale of a personal disappointment or tragedy, or perhaps the two mixed together in a toxic brew. He recalls God's character, but in this reading, he doesn't recall God as having an unchanging character. He then recalls God's saving deeds, but although he does the recalling, he's limping. And perhaps we imagine him speaking these next verses, 10 to 15, through gritted teeth. Peter, could you go to the final slide, which is four verses of a hymn? Is it possible to switch to that for a moment? And this is a hymn written by a man who suffered from deep depression, William Cowper, a Puritan. I just take one verse. There we go. I think the second verse you've got up there. You could read this very upbeat and confident, couldn't you? You fearful saints, don't be fearful. Fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread, they're actually big with mercy. And they'll break in blessings on your head. But if you knew that the man was suffering from depression when he wrote this, you'd read it a bit differently, wouldn't it? It's through gritted teeth. He's talking to himself. Ye fearful saints, take fresh courage. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy, and one day shall break in blessings on your head. So I'm suggesting that maybe 10 to 15 is more in those terms. Or possibly even, you can actually shout out what you believe as a cry of despair. I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your might among the peoples. You with your arm redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph. Why are you not doing that now? What about today? Where is he when I need him? Why does he seem to have abandoned me or turned his hand against me? As I said, those thoughts may not be Neuland to some of you. You may have experienced times like that. Certainly if we consider our brothers and sister Christians around the world under great pressure for their faith, this would ring true for them, I believe. Why is God not destroying our enemies today? And he recalls God's awesome presence. But again, I think the question on his mind as he remembers these things is, what about today? I long for his presence in the present, not in the past. And at present, he seems to be far from me. So perhaps these last verses are not spoken through gritted teeth, not a cry of despair, but more with wistfulness, a Sehnsucht, that such things would be more his experience. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. Crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters, yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So maybe the reason the ending is so abrupt is because he's not yet back on an even keel. It hasn't worked yet. He's still in the Slough of Despond, in the Sumpf der Verzagtheit. But he hasn't sunk. He's still afloat, just. He does know that you don't always see the divine footprints. In fact, you never see them. Some things remain forever cloaked in mystery about the ways of God. So he may be edging towards that upward slope. But for now, the gap remains. And you may have noticed that in your own experience. Sometimes life raises more questions than it solves. Our experience as believers in this world isn't a long series of happy endings. There'll be an ultimate happy end. But there'll be times along the way when we go through this sort of experience. Times when the distress and the darkness don't just lift like the morning mist. As one commentator puts it, God moves at his own schedule. And often the faithful must endure the anguish of waiting. And sometimes doing the right thing and remembering God and remembering the times when we were close to God actually makes us feel worse. Seems to me this psalm is for such a time as that in our experience. And you may be thinking, well, surely that shouldn't happen to us as Christians. We're in a different situation. In Christ, we have so much more evidence of God's goodness and might. How can we doubt or fear that he's changed? And hasn't Christ defeated the forces of evil on the cross? Shouldn't we be living in victory? And surely we have the Holy Spirit dwelling within us so that we should be confident that he will always lift us out of depression and restore us to confidence in God. It's certainly true, all those things that I've said. We are further down the line of what God has revealed. In Jesus, we have the fullest possible evidence of the unchanging nature of God. But Jesus doesn't just reveal to us what God is like. He also reveals humanity. He shows us what it's like to be fully human. What it's like to live as humans in an imperfect world, which in many ways hates Christ. In other words, he reveals to us the nature of humanity and also the nature of human experience. And when we think of this, of his life, we realize that true human experience may well include times of darkness. Times of not understanding what God is doing or why he's not doing something. Times when his footprints are unseen. We'll hear a reading from one of those moments in his life in a few minutes from the Garden of Gethsemane. And what was true for him is true for his followers. He didn't promise to shield us from all the anguish and distress of this world. In fact, he promised the opposite. If any man would follow me, he must take up his cross and deny himself. What he promised was that he would be with us through whatever tribulations come. Like the Good Shepherd in Psalm 23, walking with us through the valley of darkness or the valley of death. And remember, as he sent his disciples out into the world to take the gospel to all peoples, he finishes by saying, "Behold, I am with you always to the end of the age." That is true. But we won't always see the footprints. And the experience at times will be, that doesn't seem to be true in my experience. Times when we simply have to hang in there and trust. And in a way, this psalm, or this second reading of this psalm, urges us to prepare ourselves for the tough times. To build our faith so that we have right expectations and as far as possible we've done what we can to build the foundations that will stand through the times of distress and tribulation. We're going to hear now a reading from, as I said, from the Garden of Gethsemane.
It's from Matthew 26 and starting at verse 30. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.' But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter answered him, "Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away." Jesus said to him, "Truly, I tell you, this very night, before the cock crows, you will deny me 3 times. Peter said to him, Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you. And all the disciples said the same. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, Sit here while I go over there and pray. And taking with him Peter and the 2 sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me. And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And he came to his disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, So could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Again, for the 2nd time, he went away and prayed, My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So, leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the 3rd time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, Sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. This is the word of the Lord.